And welcome everyone to another very special episode of Podcasting Softly. This is Nick, and of course I'm joined by Frank. What's going on, buddy?
Not much, man. How are you doing?
Very excited. Very excited. Joining us tonight, we got a really special guest, screenwriter Matthew Sand, whose thrilling new film, Deepwater Horizon, is currently out in theaters. Matthew co-wrote the screenplay, and with filmmaker Peter Berg sitting in the director's chair. The precise and jargon-heavy screenplay is really something you got to pay attention to when watching. The research that went into this movie obviously informs the characters and what's going on in almost every scene. It's a very fast-paced movie. And while the various ecological and social tragedies that were a direct result of the Deepwater Horizon oil spin, while that's really been discussed a lot, these acts of heroism that the movie chronicles really is something that's been left by the wayside. So it's very interesting and exciting to have a movie sort of show this side of this particular incident. 11 people died during the fire and the explosions, and many more certainly would have lost their lives if it hadn't been for the brave actions of numerous people that Matthew obviously had a chance to speak to and collaborate with on this project. So we're honored to have him here for a discussion about this crazy movie and find out about his process and movies in general, what the future holds. So welcome to the show, Matthew. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Gosh, I'm glad to be here.
I just want to say up front, congratulations. I very much enjoyed this film. I echo everything Nick said in the intro. I have this fascination with topical filmmaking. I'm up on current events, so I'm always curious to see how a film that's based on a true story is going to transcend on screen. And my burning question for you is how you were able to thread the needle between making, or I should say writing, a fact-based screenplay, yet being able to flesh it out with thematic drama and conflict on a more personal level?
That's such an enormous question, and it is so much what I try to do as a writer always anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, that question is at the very core of what I like to think I do for a living. There's one sign over my desk, and it says, "Why do I care?" My job is to give you an answer to that question on a page-by-page, minute-by-minute basis. For Deepwater Horizon, I fell in love with the characters and the world and the larger story, but the moment where I felt like I had a movie was when I read about Mike Williams, played by Mark Wahlberg, getting off the rig in the middle of the fire, getting to the lifeboats, about to leave, and then seeing the lifeboats were half empty when they should have been absolutely full. And then he turned around and went back into that burning rig. And that, to me, was my definition of heroism, just in a nutshell. A father and a husband taking that risk for men who he considered his brothers, but also men he didn't know that well that day. So how did I thread the needle? By keeping close to that over and over again, never letting go of that element of the story. We did a ton of research, both in my process, which was radically different from the process that Matthew Carnahan, the writer who came after me, did, radically different from what Pete Berg did, from what the producers did, from what the actors did. But all of us, I can't even express the number of hours required to try to get to to make the story as factual as it can possibly be.
Yeah, I mean, because that's one of the very intriguing things about this particular incident, this story. There's so many different angles to it, the socio-political implications, the environmental disaster, the corporate negligence. There were seemingly so many different ways in to this story. And, from what I gather, you were responsible for adapting reading the story in the Times and then, essentially turning that into the basis of the screenplay. What was the gestation for this?
My agent at the time sent me a copy of the article, The Final Hours of the Deepwater Horizon by David Barstow. I read the article, and I thought it was a great article. I thought it did an incredible job of laying out this incredibly simple yet incredibly complex story in, 20 pages or less. I also thought, like I said, there was something that felt like classical heroism there. And then I saw a 60 Minutes piece, which featured an interview with Mike Williams, in which Mike described being, excuse me, being hit by the flying door when the explosion happened, waking up and then getting out and getting back in and getting his brothers and getting them all on the lifeboat and getting out safely. That's what got me with the whole on that 60 Minutes piece. And then there was a larger process after that of getting a movie made. And stop me if I'm going into too much depth, but I developed a pitch, about half an hour of what I thought the story should be, complete with enormous visual aids and bits and pieces of soundtracks and bits and pieces of the 60 Minutes interview. And I took that to various different buyers and got varying degrees of enthusiasm. I got a lot of pushback for issues of legal exposure from the larger studios. And then God bless participants. They were the ones who, in the very first moment, said, yes, we will finance this movie. And then I went from participant, and my producers, Lorenzo de Bonaventura and Mark Rodian. We went to, then it was Summit and Eric Feig and Jeff Shavitz, and they said yes too. And then I wrote a screenplay, and it went through almost innumerable number of hoops for 4 more years before going into production with the guy who, frankly, was always my dream director, Pete Berg.
Now, I'm fascinated with the aspect of you being a writer that's writing a true story. Now, when you're conceiving this and when you're actually putting words to paper and you're building these characters on page, at any point when you're writing this, do you imagine the real life characters, or I should say the real life people in your head as you're writing these characters, or do you start to picture, I don't know, movie stars or different actors as concepts for these different roles?
I generally don't imagine actors in the roles when I'm writing. I've always found that it puts me into creative boxes before I'm ready to be there. I have certainly done additional work on a screenplay once an actor's attached. And just to be clear, we got this movie made because of Mark Wahlberg as much as anything else. Mark embodies everything that I was trying to do. And he's such a perfect guy for Mike Williams. Do I see the real people in my head? No, I don't. I'm very much aware of having to defend my choices one day. And for me, the test is always, I imagine, particularly meeting with the families of folks who died on the rig, would I be able to say, this is as close as I could come, this is the best I could do, this is why I chose to do what I do with dialogue or action in the movie, in the screenplay. And I recognize that it is not what really happened to your son, to your husband, to your father, but it is as close as I could possibly get it. I want to believe that I can give that best effort defense, and that I'll never say I was lazy that day. It was the easy choice. There were financial reasons. I don't want to do that. I don't want to have to give an excuse if I'm faced with that situation. So that's where I come from, sort of emotionally.
What was it like during, and I'm just imagining during your process, how much did you get a chance to speak to the survivors and, you know, to the real Mike Williams and to the various people that are highlighted in the screenplay?
More of that, the firsthand research was done by Pete Berg and Matthew Carnahan, the other writer, after I was off the project. I did some, and certainly I got to know two of the survivors and several of the families very well during production and after production, Mike and Caleb, Mike especially. Mike and Felicia are just, they're awesome. They're great people. Most of my research, because of legal issues, I wasn't allowed to get too close to the families. I was able to get a ton of firsthand data, though, from other interviews, from congressional testimony, from lawsuits, from depositions. I never felt like I didn't have enough material to work off of. But the hours and hours and hours of interviews that were done, most of those were done after me.
being such a big subject as this is, I know you touched upon it briefly when you were talking about when you were pitching it, but at any point were you a little apprehensive?
Oh, constantly.
About taking this on?
I'm a neurotic writer. I worry all the time. Yes. Of course. And you know, when you're working with a true story, at least I feel so much more clearly that responsibility of just not screwing it up.
Right.
I don't want to be in a situation where someone says that just didn't happen like that. And if you weren't the schmuck, you wouldn't have said that. I live in terror of that. It is much easier, for example, adapting something that happened, say, in the 11th century. I mean, the farther back in time you go, the more leeway you have. For one thing, there aren't any survivors. There aren't any people who were there firsthand telling you were wrong. But yeah, I mean, it was a gruesome tragedy that defined the lives of hundreds of people, and then eventually thousands upon thousands of people. You want to get it right. So was I frightened? Constantly. But that's a good thing. I like being scared when I'm writing.
Yeah.
I like the sense of responsibility. You know, I have a little bit of talent. I'm good at pretty much one thing. I'm good at writing. And I try to, in my own small way, put that talent at the service of making the world in some tiny little way a little bit better.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting from what I've read about the real, you know, the actual tragedy and everything, it doesn't sound like you had to invoke too much poetic license. And I understand the need for poetic license in movies. You're making a movie, not a documentary. So there's things that have to be compressed. You have to composite things. But it basically sounds like you didn't have to invent too much because what you guys showed in this film really did occur.
We invented very little. I mean, I'll take your comments one at a time. One, we invented very little. Two, we were very much aware of the nature of this as a movie rather than a documentary, tracking certain storylines, certain characters, to the exclusion of other equally worthy storylines and worthy characters. There are a dozen different people we could have followed with equal emotional power. That's just the direction we chose to go in. And if there's anyone whose fault that is, it's mine. I was the guy who made that choice initially. And lastly, we were aware that we were not making a pro BP movie. This is not. That means we have to be careful. You know, we can't say things that just ain't true. Even if it's legally defensible, it falls apart as an argument.
But I will say one of the things that does make the movie for me as strong as it is, and I think it's fantastic. I think that as pretty much at every level it works for me. I was really blown away by the whole thing. But the thing that really cemented it for me, the conviction of it, was that you guys did not let BP off the hook. And this is a big, expensive movie with a big movie star, made by a very hot filmmaker at the moment. And I am very happy that they were not let off the hook, and you guys put your 2 cents in there and made it abundantly clear on numerous levels that not only BP, but other companies, not just BP, but that disaster was as a result of numerous mega rich corporations taking the shortcuts that would eventually lead to that occurring. And I'm glad that that was not glossed over, because sometimes, you know, that sort of subtext can get lost.
Yes. It can. And that said, you know, I my father worked for a large chemical company, a large petroleum industry company, for all my life. My education was paid for in part by deep water rigs in the North Sea off of England, off of Britain, rather. I know the territory. These are not inherently bad folks. So I'm trying to be careful with that. I'm trying to affix blame where it should properly be affixed. But that said, yeah, we came down pretty hard, and I'm proud of that. It wasn't easy. There were a lot of discussions with a lot of lawyers. And you know, Pete Berg can and has written about that.
Yeah, I imagine so. I mean, and then that kind of brings me to my original question to you, or I should say question/statement, where I do have this fascination with topical filmmaking, because I feel like a lot of times things can be glossed over or things can be rewritten. And that is one thing of many that I very much appreciated about Deepwater Horizon. So,
well, thank you.
So much a question is, you know, an accolade. This may sound very silly, to you. But not to break up the seriousness, but I am obsessed with Kurt Russell, and that guy's one of my favorite actors. And to circle back to when I asked you about your writing process and envisioning and creating characters, I just, for me, I thought the cast was phenomenal. I think Peter Berg brings together a wonderful ensemble anytime he makes a film. But I just can't imagine anybody else playing Kurt Russell's part. And I know I've spoken to Nick about this prior about the film, but I mean, you know, Kurt Russell's just the salt of the earth guy that I feel like is taking on the Lee Marvin roles in a way that oftentimes don't exist anymore in contemporary film.
One of the many things I love about my job is that sometimes I get to meet my heroes. Kurt Russell is just as awesome in person as you'd hope he would be.
Oh, that's
I've seen Big Trouble in Little China 30 times. I can quote you every Snake Plissken line from Escape from New York. I mean, this is my tombstone over and over again. He's my hero. He's my guy. And I met him, and he was fantastic. And he was amazing. It is humbling as a writer to have someone of Kurt Russell's caliber as an actor make your words sound so much better than what you wrote.
That's so fantastic to hear, because I mean, you answered my question, essentially what I was going to ask next, of what it's like to see Kurt Russell, like a
awesome
cinematic icon and you know, and badass like that, to take your words and project them on screen like that and have it be just so brutally effective. That's awesome, man. That's great.
It's awesome. It was amazing. It was super cool meeting him. And you know, I listened to his daughter, spectacular. I mean, the whole cast was just, it was take your breath away over and over again. You watch John Malkovich kill a line with incredible accent. So many moments stand out in my mind during production and watching the film for the first time, where I had to remind myself to breathe, because it was so much better than what I envisioned it being. I will also say that as much as it feels awesome, you're like, wow, I must be a great writer to have. It is so not that. It is so humbling to go on set for a movie this scope and scale and see all these incredibly talented, incredibly hardworking people giving up more than a year of their lives in most cases. All of them together doing this thing that began in my crummy little office in Hollywood. It's so much bigger, so much better, so much braver than anything I could have imagined or done by myself. I am just humbled to have been part of that experience.
Yeah, and you sort of, you know, in that response, you sort of touched on something I wanted to ask, and I know this is not your department per se, like the physical production, but one of the things that I found just so overwhelming about the movie was that it looked and felt so real, and I read that you guys were turned away, the production was turned away from various real oil rigs. Nobody allowed you guys to get on there, so instead of doing this in a computer or against green screens, this was, you know, the Deepwater Horizon was recreated at 85% scale in a 2.5 million gallon water tank or something to that effect. And I just think that when that sort of attention is paid to the setting, it makes everything feel so much more real. And to your point about these great actors getting a chance to speak your dialogue, you guys wrote a very intensely specific screenplay without really hand-holding people along, you know, like there's like 15-minute discussions about cement, you know, and like you have to pay attention, you have to listen. And that was those two contrasts, the sort of journalistic approach, the academic nature of the dialogue juxtaposed with these really big, huge images, you know, great cinematography and the whole muscular aspect of the movie. What was your response when you first saw it and you saw it on the big screen? And, you know, did it feel as overwhelming to you as it did for me?
It was two stages. First, there was visiting the set. I mean, I don't know if I'm allowed to curse on the air with you guys, but it was fucking bananas.
Absolutely. Yeah, man, go for it.
I mean, they built a rig. And not only did they build a rig out of not movie magic foam core and sheetrock, but they built it out of cold rolled wire steel. We landed a fucking helicopter, a CH-130, a big chopper, on top of the set. And so that you have that enormity of it, the surreal quality of we built one of the largest machines human beings ever built. We made a fake one for this movie. That's one. And then two, the unbelievable detail of it, that the sets for the bridge on the Bankston and on the Horizon, there was dirty coffee inside of the coffee mug. I mean, it was
you're not going to see
inside. Oh.
Yeah, it's incredible. Chris Seegers, I believe, is the production designer.
Yep.
And I was actually watching a little brief, you know, HBO 15-minute making of, and Peter Berg, or one of the producers, said that, you know, Chris Seegers was chosen because of his work on Tony Scott films, because of the experience of always doing things practical and making things real. And, you know, I've always felt that Peter Berg's style has been slightly influenced by Tony Scott in some respects, but this movie had an enormity to it that you don't normally see. You know, like, I'm thinking of movies like Titanic and Pearl Harbor and, you know, these massive productions that sort of spare no expense. And obviously you're using computers, but you're using the computers to sort of enhance everything and not dominate the show. And I can only imagine what that must be like for the actors to feel that liberated, to be out, you know, on a massive, you know, oil rig that seems fully operational. I mean, it really was extraordinary to see it, you know, and
it felt, again, sorry, go ahead.
I'm going to, you go ahead.
It felt more real even on set than it did when you were watching it on screen. And I've never had that happen. I've worked on a lot of big movies. I've been in a lot of film sets. I've never had something feel more real on the set than it was when I watched it on the screen. A lot of the machines they used, particularly during the blowout sequence, when Holloway, Dylan O'Brien's character, when he's touching the mud with his fingertips, a lot of those machines were real machines from rigs.
Yeah, it all seems
put
very
your hand
real.
On those. It was very, I mean, it really, it felt big and scary. You worried about hitting your head because they were 2.5-ton hunks of steel. Not hollow, not foam core, not soft. It was a genuinely frightening place to be. And all those guys went through a camp where they learned to operate the machinery, and it showed. And if I could real brief, could give a shout out to Dylan O'Brien. He crushed it. I thought he was just great. I remember meeting him and thinking, oh, he seems like a nice kid, I don't know. And then watching him on screen, watching him in the dailies. And yeah, he's stupendously talented. And another guy, Gino Rodriguez. I mean, the cast was just, it was phenomenal. Phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah. And to bring up a point that Nick talked about a couple questions ago, where he talked about the jargon of the film and the technicality of it. And that's one aspect I absolutely love to it. And I guess I can equate it to, and forgive this comparison if you don't like the movie, but Wall Street. And that's the thing that I love about Wall Street, and I thought it was very much akin to Deepwater Horizon, where all this technicality and jargon is being thrown at you. And I mean, I'm sitting in I live in the suburbs of Chicago, and I don't know anything about. I mean, this isn't my world that I'm watching, but and you know, I don't understand what they're saying, but I completely understand what's going on. If that makes sense to you, and I think
it
that
does.
I think that adds so much authenticity to the film. I love it. It's the detail like that I think, you know, makes Deepwater Horizon such a special film.
There is a fear of exposition that people have. You give people an expository scene in a screenplay and they go, oh my God, we can't have this in here. The audience will get bored.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, look, dude, people watch Antiques Roadshow. It's just exposition after exposition. They watch documentaries aggressively. What they don't want to have in a movie is have the plot stop while two characters who should damn well know the answer already start talking about why they're doing the thing that they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
If it feels fake and if the movie isn't real anymore, then yeah, the audience gets annoyed. But in Deepwater Horizon, I thought we had the reverse problem. There's an enormously complex machine with several enormously complex problems that results in a horrific explosion. So early on, I said, well, I'm not going to shy away from that. I mean, I actually had, and it's the first time I've ever done this, in the screenplay, I had sidebars explaining, for example, how an internal combustion engine works and why taking an aerated petroleum would be an issue. I had a sidebar on mud. I had a sidebar on why different levels of pressure were important in different ways. What's a kill line? What's a fill line?
God, that's awesome, man.
When you're writing a sidebar, are you planning that the director is going to do something with those visually, or they're going to incorporate that in a different way?
What I wrote those sidebars for was the specific audience at the stage the script was at in terms of the process. I know that this screenplay, this draft of the script, was going to a set number of individuals, most of whom I know fairly well. I know how smart they are. I have a rough sense of what they're willing to go through in terms of words on the page. And, you know, I know that if Pete Berg is reading this, or director of his caliber, he's going to know a lot of stuff, and he'll be curious as to what mud actually is. So I didn't write it to be shot that way. I wrote it to be read that way. All those sidebars certainly drop out as the script moves into production. You know, like when we started doing production drafts, yeah, the sidebars were gone. But in terms of the process of development, of getting the script to be something that they're willing to make into a movie, I found that very helpful. It allowed us to all be on the same page intellectually. I've never done that before, and I will do that again if need be.
And then there's a ton of information. I mean, like, you know, Malkovich's character even says that you know, their operation is something that's made up of a million moving parts, and that's sort of what, you know, this story felt to me. I mean, from various people from various companies all being shuttled in on that flight, you know, on the helicopter ride over, and you get the sense of community, but sort of it's foreign, and you kind of know who these people are, but not everybody knows each other. And then you get on the rig and you're dealing with the corporate, you know, visitors and everything else. And I really enjoy when somebody, a filmmaker, you guys immerse the viewer in the world, and you just sort of just plop them in and you say, here you go. And then even in the most obvious moment of, if you want to call it exposition or explanation, it makes sense because it felt organic to me with, you know, the little girl, you know, having to talk about something in her school about what her father does, because, you know, every kid has to go to school and talk about what their parents do. So you have to explain to the audience a little bit. And I thought the way that you guys did that with the Coke and the honey and the whole thing, I thought that was great. And it's visual too. And that's what I think some filmmakers forget, is that they get too bogged down by the words and they forget that you're there to tell, you know, in my opinion, you're supposed to be telling stories with pictures. That's what these are. So for you guys to do that, and not overplay that.
Honestly, that's Pete Berg. Pete Berg never loses sight of the emotion in any scene he shot in his life, as far as I can tell. And no matter how big, no matter how complicated, no matter how many people are shouting at him in 14 different ways, Pete Berg is capable of honing in on the emotional truth of the scene like no one else I've worked with, and it is an astonishing gift. That's one other thing that occurred to me in listening to you was, I think that human beings like to be given a world, and it's a potential inherent in the medium of film. I mean, it looks like a window. It's got sight and it's got sound. And I think that certainly I like to be given different worlds. And frankly, it's why I don't see that much difference in writing science fiction versus writing historical fiction. In both cases, I'm giving you a world onto a different reality.
I'm always curious to ask writers. I love speaking to writers. Off the top of your head, not to put any pressure on some sort of list, but what do you think are some of the best screenplays to ever have been on film?
Oh, best screenplays. The one that I go to over and over again that I wish I had done and did not, obviously, Seven Samurai. Arguably my favorite movie of all time. You know, ask me on Monday and they have a different answer. I think Groundhog Day is a stupendously elegant analysis of a problem and a solution. It is just a brilliant script.
So amazing.
I love Wonder Boys for the heart of it, and probably that's Curtis Hanson's direction, but it's just a beautiful, beautiful screenplay based on a beautiful novel. I thought that J.C. Chandor did a stupendous job with his first big movie, whose title I'm blanking on now, the one about Wall Street. Margin Call, with a great script by a great writer. Other great screenplays. You know, there are writers whose writing I love, and I know them by writing. Steve Zalian, one of our biggest writers out here. I can tell a script he has written within half a page. His voice is so utterly distinctive, it bounces off the page. I must have read 20 scripts by him. Scott Frank, another giant writer, another guy who I admire enormously. Billy Ray. These are writers, they have a style that I, as a writer, I'm so drawn to, so impressed by. Aaron Sorkin, obviously, not a bad writer. The kid's got a future. A Few Good Men is an absolutely brilliant screenplay. It is so tight. He's so comfortable with dialogue and so aware of the things you can do with it that are neither plot nor character, and yet are at once plot and character. It's really tough to do. I like writers that feel like themselves and nobody else. All those guys are just waiting for you. So when you ask me, like, what are films with great screenplays, I find it a little bit difficult to isolate the script from the movie. Mm-hmm. You know, is Seven Samurai the best screenplay ever? I don't know, but it may be the best movie ever. I can't tell you where the script ends and where I know when I read a script, I'm aware of what's great about that script. But when I watch a movie, well, is the scene that great or did the actor just kill it? You know, it's somebody once said, it was a screenplay that described the landing on D-Day. It said the boats land on the beach, and that was the end of the scene. Well, shit, is that a great screenplay because you end up with Saving Private Ryan? I don't know. I know when I write giant, amazing, extraordinary action sequences, I choose my adjectives very carefully. I choose make Pete film the explosion the way he did? No, I don't think so. That wasn't me. That was him.
How do you write action? You know, like, and that's one of the things, and I'm a huge action movie fan. I love action movies that, you know, every subgenre that there could be. And I'm always fascinated by what the next great action movie is going to be and what's, you know, how visually dynamic can somebody make it. But when you're actually writing action out on the page, you know, this thing explodes and, you know, Kurt Russell's blown, you know, back, five times back and forth between the glass and everything, you know, which is just an extraordinary sequence. I can't believe that guy lived. I just don't get it. But what is that like to write action? How detailed do you get?
Oh God. Again, this is a wonderful long answer question. I'll tell you, in Deepwater Horizon, there were a couple things that happened there. I tried to make it as specific as I possibly could, which I always do. Specificity is more interesting than broad generalizations always. It's not being blown backwards. It's arms and legs tangled. He slams into this side of the thing and his foot, it's the more I can get to the intimacy of it, the shard of glass in his foot, for example, in that Kurt Russell sequence. That's one. Two is, I try to focus on the character because I knew there was a lot of stuff going on. I didn't want you to lose sight of the characters. So I didn't do a ton of pulling back and showing you the crane shot or the helicopter overhead. There's one very specific instance in the script, which was in the movie also, of showing the Coast Guard going to the satellite view and seeing in the darkness the burning eye of fire. Because that's the one moment where you do genuinely leave the character's point of view. I'll tell you something else that I did in the screenplay for Deepwater Horizon, which I've never done before. It was very specific to this project, was I wrote all the scenes prior to the explosion in complete sentences because I wanted to give you that sense of taut stillness. I tried to make every sentence feel as complete as possible, as prose as possible. Once the explosion happened, I went into staccato fragment sentences. Almost every one of them was an incomplete sentence. I used a lot of ellipses, a lot of dashes, none of which I used prior to the explosion, because I wanted to convey that there really was a massive change in terms of momentum of the screenplay before and after the thing blows up. I don't think that anyone reading it was aware of that on a strictly conscious level, but I do think it influences how it was read.
Yeah, and the pace of the film is also, I mean, just between the editing and the way that it was written and the focus, you know, that's the thing too, is that, you know, there's not too many cutaways, and it's inessential action and the various bits where you're showing the process of the rescue. All of that is handled in such an economical way. I mean, I really just was like, I was really impressed by how many departments that were highlighted and people from various groups and agencies that stepped in to help. And incredible. And the way that you guys streamlined it and showed, another movie that came out earlier this year, Sully, sort of touched upon this, these people doing these jobs that we take for granted and, they come, they're there to sort of do the things that no one ever really wants to do. And they do them really well in both of these instances. And, without the help of those people, certainly more than 11 people are not going to.
Oh, God, yes. So the Coast Guard was amazing, amazing. And interesting, it didn't make it into the movie, but we certainly talked about it. The guy who was captain, not the guy who was captain, the guy who was on the small rescue boat, the FRC, off the Damon Bankston, he won a Medal of Honor for his actions that night. For rescuing so many people. You guys made me think of something that is one of my giant pet peeves as a writer. And if I can just get into it for a brief second, indulge me.
Oh, yeah.
In talking about writing screenplays and talking about the different stages your screenplay goes through, and how I wrote sidebars on technical information and used complete sentences and then sentence fragments, this is why it's so exhausting to me and my fellow screenwriters when somebody leaks a copy of a screenplay and puts it on the internet. Because you have no idea, reading it, what stage of the process that draft was intended for. That stage of the process may in fact have been the director wants to try something, the actor wants to try something, the studio wants to try something, and I'm going to give them all three versions, even though I know in my gut that version two won't work. You guys may have leaked the version that I knew didn't work. Or this may be the version where we tried to cut the budget by 40%, and it was crummy. So we said, you know what, we got to go back up to where we were originally. And it may be, again, it may be something that is consciously not going to be as good a movie as the draft previous or the draft that comes next. And that happens all the time. I would say most drafts that you write in the development process have some element of that. So that when you find yourself reading something on some website, you go, oh, Jesus, guys, it wasn't that wasn't it. You weren't supposed to look at this draft because it was never going to be in the movie. So that's my pet peeve of the week. Thank you for indulging me.
Absolutely.
And I can see that being a massive pet peeve because, like you said, a core group of people know exactly what's going on with any movie at any given moment. And, things change so fast that, what was being done on Monday is not being done on Tuesday. So absolutely.
Yep.
I could see that being extraordinarily irritating.
It's a very strange process.
How long do you think it took you to write the screenplay from, say, first draft to your final draft of it?
Ooh. I generally write a draft of a screenplay. Once I have an outline and I finish the research, I generally write a draft in a month. I don't think this took me less or more time than usual to write that rough draft. The research obviously took me considerably more time than usual. And then I went through at least 5 months of additional drafts. And then there was a long hiatus, and then I came back and did another draft. And then there was another guy who came in, and he was directing also. He did a draft, and we didn't use his draft, but we used his research. And then Carnahan came in, did a draft. And then Carnahan went off, and then there's another. It was this long, iterative process.
Yeah.
So it becomes very difficult to say, oh, this is how long it took to write this script. I will tell you that I know if it takes me more than a month and a little bit to write a first draft, I haven't figured out what I'm trying to say. And I need to sit down and look at my outline again.
And what was your reaction when you heard that Peter Berg would be the one to direct?
Ecstatic. I was ecstatic. I was over the moon. So happy. He was always, always, always. When I read this article, I was watching Friday Night Lights for the third time, the whole TV series. And I always thought, I mean, listen, it's a Texas, it's a Louisiana story. It's a blue collar hero story. It's a hero story. There are elements of religion, there are elements of brotherhood, and it's everything Pete does as good as anyone has ever done. So yeah, ecstatic. I mean, I my hand to God, I mentioned him the first time I sat with my agent and talked about this being a movie.
It's awesome. Yeah, I mean,
great, man. Wow.
Huge fan of his work, and like you said, you know, he gets that milieu, and you know, Friday Night Lights was a, you know, the movie was huge for me, and the TV show was a complete obsession. I was just so consumed by that TV show and the way that it was told and everything about it. And yeah, and I'm super pumped that, you know, he's doing these movies that are, you know, about, you know, real stories, and he's trying to, and seemingly from what I've read, he's really only interested in telling these stories from now on. He's, you know, he's had his chance to make a couple of, you know, superhero comic book things, and he's gotten that out of his system. And I think it's exciting. And, you know, I like movies that touch on stuff that's going on around us. And I think that this is one of the, you know, again, that this movie could have been made in so many different ways. I mean, you could have told this movie strictly from the environmental point of view. You could have told this movie from the, you know, interior halls of the corporations that were responsible for this. So I just think that it's an important movie, a timely movie, and it's exciting. And, you know, I just think it's an amazing job you did. So really, you should be very proud.
Thank you very much. I am proud. And I'm also very, I'm very much aware of the vanishingly small nature of my own contributions to the finished whole. It's a lot bigger than me.
Probably being a little modest there, but what do you, anything that you can tell us about that's coming up in the future that you're working on?
I'm working on a couple things. I'm working on a mini series about Teddy Roosevelt. I am working on adapting a novel for Paramount, a Cory Doctorow novel called Little Brother. And I'm working with the BBC and Canal Plus on a story about the Third Crusade, Richard Lionheart and Saladin. Three things that I'm really excited about.
Oh, Richard the Lionheart stuff, that would be great. Yeah.
I like telling stories about real people. There's something, and history is wonderful. But look, the Cory Doctorow novel, fan-fucking-tastic. I mean, Cory may be one of the few genuine geniuses I've met in my life, and he wrote a hell of a novel.
What's the log line? I'm not familiar.
It takes place day after tomorrow. There's a terrorist attack in San Francisco, and a bunch of hacker kids, part of the hacker subculture, because of the technology they're using, they are blamed, or at least held responsible to some degree, for the terrorist attack. And it becomes a question of clearing their names and pushing back against an overly industrious, let's call it, division of the Homeland Security.
Sounds awesome.
Cool. Yeah, man. That sounds awesome.
It's fun. It's fun.
And so you're a writer that can work on multiple projects at once, or no?
Yes. I've never been comfortable doing one thing at a time. If I'm working on one thing and I have a bad day, I'm convinced I'll have to sell my child and go work in a hardware store or something. when I have two things, I can go from one that's having a hard day to one that's having an easier day. I've always been happier that way. That said, when I'm writing, actually doing pages for the first time, it becomes pretty monomaniacal.
Well, thank you very, very much for chatting with us, Matthew.
It was a total pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, man, this was incredible. Seriously, thank you for taking the time out to speak with us. This was great.
Seriously, if I have opportunities in the future, please call.
Yeah, without a doubt. We would love to speak with you, have you back on, talk about Seven Samurai, whatever, man. This was fantastic.
Oh, I would love that. Truly,
yeah,
truly.
Sure.
Guys, thank you very much.